The Science Show on RN, where I'd like you to meet once more one of those Nobel Prize winners from Caltech. The small campus in Pasadena has about three times as many Nobels as the whole of Australia. And David Baltimore used to be its director. We first talked when the Science Show was just weeks old, because you won the Nobel Prize in 1975 for work on, well, viruses and something called reverse transcriptase. And one thing that puzzled me always, when viruses come into the body, whatever body it is, whatever host, that they take over the mission control, if you like, our DNA, and invade and put their DNA in, which then can be reproduced to make more viruses. Well, imagine that they're there in your DNA, their little patch, their little piece of barcode. How do they then make copies of themselves? They're primitive things. They're just a strip of chemical.
Well, it's like any organism on Earth. The way that the virus controls a cell is through the proteins that are made under the direction of its DNA or RNA. And so to duplicate themselves, they have to duplicate their DNA or their RNA. And they've appropriated the machinery from cells that's designed to duplicate DNA and RNA. And their DNA and RNA are no different than the cell's DNA. So they duplicate themselves and they package up what they've made into little particles, and those are the virus particles, and then they get them out of the cell and get them around the body so they go and infect other cells, and they get them out on the surface where they go and infect other people. And so they transmit their ability to duplicate from one person to another in the process causing disease.
It's a terribly sneaky thing, isn't it?
Well, it's appropriating the technology that evolved for the organism's use, and so they're parasites. There are a lot of parasites in the world. I mean, when you go out around your body, there are parasites. There are parasites on all the trees, and there are parasites on DNA.
But when you did the work on how this sort of mechanism takes place, AIDS was unknown, or HIV was unknown. And so when it came to be, how was it clear that there might be an answer to treating AIDS from the work you've done?
Well, we identified the key enzyme that allows the virus to duplicate its DNA or its RNA. And that enzyme is quite unique to the viruses. So to stop those viruses from growing, the simplest idea would be to make an inhibitor of that enzyme that inhibited the virus's enzyme but doesn't inhibit cellular equivalent enzymes. And that's exactly what was done. And it was done because the viruses were associated with cancer, and so the drugs were made as anti-cancer drugs. And when the AIDS epidemic appeared at our doorstep, about 10 years after I discovered the reverse transcriptase, we had inhibitors sitting on the shelf. And some bright chemists said, let's see if they'll inhibit AIDS, and they did. And so the very first drugs that were made were drugs that were repurposed from anti-cancer drugs. And once the principle was established, then the pharmaceutical industry set out to make consciously drugs against the reverse transcriptase of the AIDS virus. So they got better and better drugs because they were making them against just the right target.
Well, leaping forward many, many years to last October, November, news came out that in China, a scientist called He had actually jumped a kind of generation by trying to insert and succeeding to insert something in the DNA, in the genome of unborn twins to make them resistant to HIV. And there was a huge fuss. It just happened to coincide with a major conference. Were you there, actually?
I ran the conference.
You ran the conference. Yes, indeed. I thought you may have done that. And was the eruption of news unexpected?
Totally unexpected. Just before I left the United States to go to Hong Kong, I got wind of this. And then once I landed, it was the topic of conversation. And you say it was coincidental. We're not sure it was coincidental because it was known when this conference was going to take place. And you can easily subtract 9 months and decide when you want to implant an embryo so that it's born just before the conference.
Oh dear, sneaky in the extreme. One thing that was puzzling as to whether this was a remedy that made sense, I know that the father of the twins was a carrier of HIV, but was it a procedure that seemed to be likely to be adopted generally?
No, absolutely not. It is neither the right way to go about it, nor is it necessary. We can prevent the transmission from a father to offspring quite effectively by, first of all, treating the father with drugs that inhibit the virus. That won't get you to 100%, but it gets you to 99%. And then you can get the rest of the way by washing sperm. So if you use in vitro fertilization techniques, you can, with washed sperm, have children born with really no probability of having HIV.
But was there a suggestion that what her had done would enable the children to be somehow immune to infection?
Well, if he had knocked out both copies of CCR5 gene, which is what he tried to do, then yes, those children would be immune. But it has nothing to do with whether their father was HIV infected or not. You could do this to any child. The question is it totally safe to do that? Now, we know there are people who lack these CCR5 genes, and those people live an apparently normal lives. And so if you say, well, apparently they're all right, then you could say, well, we could afford to live without that gene. But if they lived under somewhat different circumstances, particularly if they were likely to be infected by West Nile virus, then they may lack a defense by losing the CCR5 protein. And so in a different circumstance, it may be actually quite dangerous for them.
Why are scientists in general against having genes of embryos changed?
I wouldn't say that scientists are against doing it. I would say that scientists are leery off-target effects because they could cause any sort of gene to be defective, and you wouldn't necessarily even know it without sequencing the DNA of the offspring. And there's no way to retrieve that. Once it's happened, unless you go in every generation and make sure that you're not transmitting it, which would be very difficult, it's now a permanent part of the human DNA.
Yeah, they've been passed on by the twins indefinitely.
Exactly. And these modified genes that Dr. Herr made are going to be passed on from generation to generation unless they sterilize the children, which I think is very unlikely to take place.
As you're retiring from the lab and working in the United States with a very strange political situation, what's it like doing science these days after 2 years of Trump?
Well, in the past, we were, as scientists, honored, and the bulk of the population felt that we were doing work that was positive for the population in general and for the civilization. We're not so sure that people see us that way anymore, and certainly the president doesn't, and the people he's circled around himself, his cabinet, don't. They want to create facts that satisfy their political needs, and they don't care about what the truth is. Of course, most egregious place where that takes place is in the discussions of climate change, where it is so obvious that the climate is changing under the pressure of human beings that most people don't even argue about that statement anymore. And yet, people in power in the United States today don't believe that, or at least profess to not believing that, and certainly act as if they don't believe it.
Can you understand why they might be doing that? You know, what's the point of their knocking science like that?
I guess the question is, do they believe what they're saying, or do they not believe it? And it's very hard to tell the difference. It has always been true that there are people who simply will not believe things that the vast majority of people take for granted, like the Earth is round. There are flat earthers. How can they believe that? You can see the horizon, but they do. It's the same thing with climate change. I think there are probably fewer and fewer people believing that climate change is not anthropogenic, not made by humans, but still there are quite a number of those people. And it's a sort of joke in the scientific community that when a scientist has an idea that is not generally thought to be reasonable, and some do, you don't argue them out of it. You just wait for them to die. And then the next generation thinks differently. But there are a few holdovers, so there will always be people.
It's an interesting thing. If you look at the money, always follow the money. Whatever was being said in the White House, nonetheless, Congress voted funding for science on a very, very impressive scale.
Yes, they did. We were sort of wringing our hands that the funding of science was going to go down. And if you looked at the budget recommendations from the White House, they were for 25% cuts in science across the board. And Congress simply wouldn't listen to that. Congress said science is too important and that it needs increased funding, not decreased funding. And so, in fact, there was increased funding for science, that we're still funding climate change science. We're funding biomedical science more generously than any other country in the world.
And it's also impressive that you've got a number of people in the private sector, and you've talked to them, who are still providing huge amounts of money.
Well, we have philanthropists who are devoting their fortunes, or some of their fortunes, to science. I work with some of these people. They understand that basic science is the way that we illuminate our understanding of the universe, and they help us do that.
And what do they like to work with, especially Bill Gates? You were saying that Bill Gates sometimes likes to give private funding because he finds his own foundation rather too bureaucratic.
Yes. Gates is a very curious and very smart and very well-educated man. That's not necessarily true of other philanthropists, many of whom find science opaque, but they understand how critical it is. And so they fund science without even pretending to have an understanding of exactly what it is their money's being used for. Gates is different. Gates reads science books for pleasure. I've been in a room with him when he just recently read a book, and he has all sorts of detailed questions to ask about it. A very wonderful man to be with.
What about Mark Zuckerberg?
Mark is much younger than Bill Gates, also a very smart man. A little, I think, less sort of academically curious, more interested in the social side of humans. But here he is devoting $3 billion to basic science at UCSF, at Stanford, and around the country. Probably doesn't try to understand every detail of what he's supporting, but believes that this is what he ought to be doing.
Finally, back to science and back to cancer. You're working on a new line there. What is it?
I've been working some on immunotherapy for cancer and have had a general program called Engineering Immunity, in which we use gene transfer methods to modify the immune systems so that they're more effective in dealing with cancer and AIDS.
You're marshalling your own immune system to fight back.
Right. Your immune system has capabilities that it usually doesn't demonstrate because there are all sorts of breaks built into the immune system. So when you, for instance, have a cold, your system reacts to that very fast and very floridly. You feel terrible. You sneeze and cough and all of that. That's all your immune system getting to work. But if you're going to go back to being a healthy individual, all of that has to be suppressed. And so the immune system is as complicated in its suppression of itself as it is in the activation of itself. If you want the immune system to last longer, cancer is a long-term effort by the body. And so you want to take the brakes off the immune system. We've only in the last short while learned how to take those brakes off, what those brakes are and how to take them off. And that's the biggest thing going on in cancer research today.
Well, our own chief scientist to the previous one, not the one at the moment, Alan Finkel, but Ian Chubb, had, it looks like, his life saved by being one of the experimental people who got that sort of treatment.
Well, that's wonderful to hear.
Well, thank you yet again. After four interviews since 1975, I'll see you in 10 years.
Okay.
He'll be 90 by then. Nobel laureate Dr. David Baltimore, one of those who helped save thousands and thousands of lives from AIDS. He's still at Caltech in California.